While I've been away for the past 4 weeks, Free Forum has featured pre-recorded interviews with some wonderful guests. But I'm glad to be back, and I look forward to spending the next hour with you and with Michael Lind, one of the smartest, historically knowledgeable, and clear-thinking progressives around. We'll talk about the state of the nation, the first 7 months of the Obama administration, health care, climate change, Wall Street, K Street, Main Street, and what maybe we can do to shake things up. My take? I'm deeply frustrated by the weak half-measures Obama seems wedded to. I get the impression that he's completely non-ideological, except for the ideology of bipartisanship and compromise. And what has he gotten for his troubles? Well, not a single GOP vote for the stimulus, AstroTurf mobs shouting down his health care plans. And it's worse than it seems because he traded away, the Democrats traded away $40 billion in stimulus to the states, and they got nothing in return. Probably no stimulus money would have been as immediately spent or as politically or psychologically rewarding. Why that $40 billion package hasn't been revived, I don't understand. Corporations that are too big to fail get billions to spend on bonuses, while California stops caring for seniors and children, cuts summer school, and closes state parks. I look at the bailout, the climate bill, and where we likely are headed in health care, and no matter how many small contributors think they made history in the last election, corporate money trumps them every time once the self-congratulatory parades are over. We've got an apparently progressive president, big Democratic majorities in both houses, a national crisis that everyone agrees calls for action, and a failed and repudiated previous administration. Now talk about the stars being aligned, and yet Max Baucus, Billy Towson, and their crew just shrug and go on about their business. And before I bring in Michael Lind, I want to share specifically some thoughts about the healthcare debate, especially how Obama is dealing with the public option. Okay? Front page story in the LA Times, August 16th, 2009. Quote, during an otherwise placid town hall meeting in Green Junction, Colorado, with 16,000 people packing a high school gymnasium, one University of Colorado student challenged Obama to an Oxford-style debate over the so-called public option. His question, quote, how in the world can private companies providing insurance compete with an entity that does not have to worry about making a profit, does not have to pay local property taxes, or face local regulations? Zach Lahn asked Obama, how can a company compete with that? Now, I've been watching the debate, and this was, I think, the last question. And as I watched the video screen, I started offering encouragement to the president. You know, go for it, man. This one's right down the middle. Don't foul it off. Come on. But soon, I ended up screaming at the screen more in frustration, as Obama joked a bit with the questioner about his chutzpah, and then he launched into a wonky defense of the public option, basically bragging about how if you tied both hands behind its back, it might not offer such tough competition. Now, here's a rough draft of how I would have answered. Okay, this is me as President Obama. You're right. It might be hard for private insurance to compete with public not-for-profit health insurance, but that's not really my number one priority. My number one priority is the health of Americans. We spend more than any other nation per person and more as a percentage of GDP on health, and we don't get the results. I'm committed to that changing. When I leave office, whether it's in 3.5 years or 8, I want Americans to be healthier. Too many may think it's unpatriotic to say the United States doesn't have the best healthcare system in the world, but that's just a way of avoiding facing the problem and having to deal with it. And by the way, the dictionary defines courage as the willingness to face and deal with things recognized as difficult, dangerous, or painful, rather than withdraw from them. We have the best research hospitals. We have the best medical schools. We have the best doctors. We have the best equipment. But we do not have the best health. We do not have the best health outcomes. So instead of denying the truth, recognize the problem. If we've got the best, but we're not achieving the best, then the system is broken. We got to figure out how it got broken, and we have to do everything we can to fix it. This is too important to our economy, to our morale as a nation, to our competitiveness, and most important, to the health and the peace of mind of you, your children, your parents. My goal is about health. We'll do things about prevention and education and access to early care for all. We'll do everything we can, but your health will still be up to you, and so will your health care. What I aim to improve is how we pay for it. And if giving more people Medicare-type health care does that, it's worth doing. You see, there's a problem that explains some of that bad news, why we spend more and we don't get what we pay for. We may have the best doctors, hospitals, researchers, scientific advances, but the big reason the numbers don't add up, profits. Health is essential, like safety, and we don't expect firefighters or police to make a profit. Medicare works. And by the way, for those who don't want government messing with their Medicare, let me let you in on a little secret. Medicare is government health care. Medicare has overhead of 4%. That means 96 cents out of every dollar goes to your health. For-profit insurance has higher overhead, naturally. They've got to make a profit. They've got to market, advertise, do tons of paperwork, and pay thousands of people to try not to pay for your medical bills. Medicare doesn't have to do that, and neither will a public program. Think of it as giving everyone the choice to join Medicare no matter his or her age. The difference is you'll pay premiums until you're 65. If we can cut costs, then maybe we can lower that. It would be my goal that in the future it might be free at 60 or maybe later at 55. But for now, it's not free. But your premiums are going to be lower than private insurance. Why? Because like Medicare, a public plan doesn't have to make a profit. It doesn't have to market. We'll do public education. We'll let people know it's available. We'll make it easy for them to sign up. But no extra advertising. And just like anybody else, we'll have people looking out for fraud, and we will commit to cutting that at every turn, because every dollar lost in fraud is a dollar not helping Americans get healthier. And in the public choice, we're not paying anybody to try to figure out a way to not pay your bills or to cancel your policy or to make any decisions that are better for their bottom line than for your health. So yes, if I were a private insurer and I looked at Medicare's overhead and my overhead and I saw a difference of, say, 15 cents a dollar, I'd be concerned how I was going to compete. But remember, my goal as president is not to save private insurance companies, and it's not to eliminate them. It's to improve the health of Americans. You know whose job it is to figure out how to compete with a simple not-for-profit alternative and still make a profit? It's the insurance companies. Let's look at it two ways. If a public plan, something like Medicare, ends up doing all the terrible things so many are screaming it will do, then only the desperate will sign up, and the private insurers will continue to make their profits on everyone else. But if the public option isn't half bad, if it's as good as Medicare, then maybe they've got something to worry about. Then they've got to show that for-profit insurance is worth the extra cost. They've got to treat patients better than the public plan. They've got to bring down premiums, so they've got to work harder to bring down costs without sacrificing quality, because now people will have a choice. So let me return to the question that I brought up at the top of this. If all the other advanced countries offer a public option and they spend less and get better results, and by the way, I said that on purpose because most of those other countries still offer private insurance as well, then it is up to for-profit insurance to prove there's a significant place for it in the health of Americans in the future. If the public option serves some people who prefer it and drives for-profit insurance to improve, we all win. And remember, my first priority is the overall health of all Americans. So, that's what I would have said, but hey, I'm just a radio host. You can email me at temcnally@mac.com and let me know what you think. And now, Michael Lind.
Well, glad to join you.
Now, I'm going to let you respond to my intro, but first, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about, so in a review of your mid-90s book, Up From Conservatism, Amazon.com calls you a former rising star of the right. So, who changed, Michael, you or the right?
Well, a little bit of both. I've always considered myself a New Deal Democrat in the Roosevelt, Truman, Kennedy, and Johnson tradition. And this made me a hawk during the Cold War. And then after the Cold War ended, there was really no reason to stick around the right anymore, particularly as it became more and more identified with what actually had been the Southern Democratic tradition, not the Republican tradition. And so I was about a decade ahead of other people, I think, warning about the Southern takeover of the Republican Party by what is essentially the values of the Confederates. So what we have now, I think you have to look at it in historic perspective. The Republican Party today really is the old Dixiecrats. You know, its base is the old segregationist Dixiecrats. And the base of the Democrats and the rest of the country, as strange as this may seem, is the Lincoln Republicans. So I'm just one of many people in my generation who tried to hang on to particular values while the partisan landscape shifted violently back and forth.
Okay.
But I prefer to call myself a liberal to a progressive.
I know you do.
Partly because I think progressive is kind of weaselly, you know, it's sort of we're liberals, but we don't want to say so because Rush Limbaugh has defined it. And partly because there were real serious philosophical differences between the progressives of the early 1900s who were into things like prohibition and eugenics.
Uh-huh.
And the New Dealers who were much more welcoming of immigrants and associated with civil rights, but that's a terminological matter.
Right. But I know that I think it was right after Obama's election, I think, you did a piece in Salon, said, now can we call ourselves liberals again?
Well, the people who were pushing the term progressive, some were on the left, but a lot of them were people like Will Marshall at the Progressive Policy Institute, you know, named Progressive.
Yeah.
and these were the Clinton triangulators.
Right. Right.
And not only did they not like the phrase liberal, they didn't like the liberal policies. I mean, they essentially rejected the New Deal paradigm, you know, for mixed economy with full employment in favor of what's called neoliberalism. And I don't think you can understand Barack Obama except as the third neoliberal president after Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton. You know, they are not part of the New Deal tradition. They, all three of them, consciously have broken with it in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the voice you hear is Michael Lind, and I just want to tell you a little bit about him, which I didn't in the intro. Got carried away with my own rant. He's a senior research fellow and the policy director of New America's Foundation's Economic Growth Program. His first three books on political journalism and history, The Next American Nation, Up from Conservatism, and Vietnam, The Necessary War, were all New York Times notable books. He's written a couple of other books, including one made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of America. And Lind is, as he said, a Texan, or grew up a Texan. And he's been an editor or staff writer for The New Yorker, Harper's, New Republic, and he writes frequently now. I read him most often now at Salon.com. Okay, let me go even away from politics for a second, Michael. You've written, as I said, about a dozen books of history and political journalism, but you've also written fiction. You've written poetry. A book of yours, Blue Bonnet Girl, a children's book in verse, won an Oppenheimer Toy Prize for Children's Literature. And the L.A. Times named your long narrative poem, The Alamo, one of the best books of 97. That's pretty impressive to me. What do you feel?
Well, thanks. When you run for president and get elected, you can give me some kind of award or something, maybe.
Okay. Based on that,
I definitely think on the basis of your introductory remarks, you ought to challenge Obama in the primaries.
I appreciate that, Michael. You're the first one who said
it. Got my vote.
Okay, thank you. Well, as I was going to say about writing, you've written in all these different genres, and we'll get in. We got an hour here. We're going to get into plenty of policy. But what for you connects and separates those different kinds of writing?
Well, I think what connects them is story. It's narrative. That is, you can't understand what is happening right now. We're in medias res. That was the term in epic literature for Homer and Virgil. Open their epic poems right in the middle of the action, and then everything that came before and what goes on after the book concludes, you get through flashbacks or foreshadowing. And so at any given moment, I think that's just true in life in general, but it's also true in every genre, whether it's political journalism or fiction. There's a story before the opening of the book or the play, and there's something that will follow it. And so you cannot understand what is happening right now unless you understand what went before. Now, you can go overboard. For example, Sir Walter Raleigh wrote History of England, in which he began with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. That's going a bit too far back. Yeah. You'd have to go back to the Big Bang.
Right, right.
There is a plot. You know, there is a narrative. There are causes and effects. And the problem with much of our public discourse is it's as though we all have amnesia, and we have a file dump, and we erase our memories every 5 years. And you see this with the liberal or the progressive tradition, whatever you want to call it. There are fewer and fewer people thinking of this as rooted in the struggles of Martin Luther King and of the New Deal and of the progressives and the populists in the 19th century. It's as though there are simply all of these issues floating around in a vacuum. And, you know, depending on which blog you read, the progressives have one set of issues and the conservatives have another. But I think that's what's missing. And it's what I try to provide in my nonfiction. It's the sense that we walked onto the stage halfway through the play, but in order to understand our own lines, we have to understand what the plot is.
Very good. So in other words, if you leave out the big narrative to which all these smaller stories fit or are in sync, then it really does look like you take a pot shot at this and a pot shot at that. But if you can gather it within a big narrative, I think it's not only easier to understand, it's easier to sell.
Well, also the successful forces, which have been the conservative forces in politics since the 80s until recently, they have a big picture. They don't share it with you. For example, the whole project of the radical right since the 60s and 70s was to repeal the New Deal in domestic policy by destroying its crown jewel, Social Security, through privatization, deregulating everything. And then in foreign policy, it was to replace liberal internationalism, post-World War II democratic foreign policy, with right-wing unilateralism. They knew exactly what they were doing, but of course they didn't give away the plot. They pretended that they were simply responding on an issue-by-issue basis.
Well, now, wait, let me see, because I thought you perhaps were going to say, and I will say I believe, that they have done a better job of some sort of a big narrative, and it's that we're the current incarnation of the Founding Fathers. This is a Christian nation, and it's all about freedom and individualism. And Jefferson didn't believe in big government, and neither do we.
No, that's right. They do have history. Now, it's often a cherry-picked, you know,
of course,
audit history. But I'll give you an example. When you go to the Cato Institute, last time I was there, it's the Libertarian Institute, they have pictures of historic figures on the wall, like Jefferson and Tom Paine.
And quotes, I'll bet.
Yeah, I go to progressive think tanks and institutions and activist groups, and they never have any pictures of anyone dead.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so and there's not this sense that the center-left is heir to people in the past,
mm-hmm.
You know, that it's part of an ongoing concern that fought battles in the past and will fight battles in the future. It's very technocratic,
mm-hmm.
Very kind of academic. You know, it's as though the past, and I think this may get us off topic, but I think what happened in the middle of the 20th century is that liberals, instead of, there was this whole language of, you know, the American Revolution is ongoing, the battle for unions is part of the spirit of 1776, grows out of the American Revolution. And as the center of liberalism moved to the university, you had social science increasingly replaced history and tradition as the basis for liberal reform. And we see an example of that before our very eyes. There's all this enthusiasm among progressives for behavioral economics, right?
You know, right,
what's called libertarian paternalism, Cass Sunstein. Yeah, it's an interesting idea. But the thing is, that's not the way the right works. You know, they say we have these values that are hundreds and hundreds of or thousands of years old, and we're fighting for them in changing circumstances. Whereas all too often the left says, oh, look, there's a new theory somebody came up with. Let's apply this theory to public policy.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if you're driven by, you know, fashions in the universities, then you really don't have this solid foundation to build on, in my opinion.
Right. And the other thing I'm just going to say before I tell people who we're talking to is that when you say falling back on social science rather than history, what you end up with data rather than stories, when in fact it's that combination of a strong human story and then, you know, a piece of data that illustrates this isn't just an anecdote, this is happening out there, that I think is the strong way to make the case for anything.
Well, I think this is what is missing from President Obama's oratory. You know, he's a great speaker. But he lacks what you found in Roosevelt and Lincoln at the last two turning points in American history, as I see it. They went to great lengths to justify all of their departures from the existing system in terms of going all the way back to the American founding.
Sure.
You know, for Lincoln, it's the Declaration of Independence, and slavery is a violation of this. And it's less well-known, but Franklin Roosevelt, both when he was running for president at a speech at the Commonwealth Club, but also in his speech during World War II on the Second Bill of Rights, went to great length rehearsing all of American history, saying that the founding fathers fought against political tyranny and established political freedom. We must now establish economic freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's completely different from the approach that not just President Obama, but much of the Democratic Party, have been taking, which is to say, well, we have these problems of the uninsured and of costs, and here's our technocratic reform.
Right.
Right.
I appreciate that that sort of look at the big picture. Now let's get more specific. I want to start with the issue of health care first. You kind of hinted at it, but your response to my take.
Yeah, I thought your speech was right on, and I would take on this question of entitlements and entitlement spending, because liberals have allowed the entitlement to be defined by Ross Perot and Pete Peterson and various deficit hawks on the right as something evil. Entitlements are rights.
Yeah.
They're rights. And when conservatives say the only rights that anyone in a society should have should be those of the 17th century, that doesn't even understand, that's based on misunderstanding of Locke and of Jefferson themselves. The reason why in Lockean Jeffersonian social contract liberalism, which is the ideology that the right invokes, the reason why people form a society is to secure their basic natural rights. And they do so by creating government and government programs. They can create markets to do it if they want to, but they can also create government agencies. And what's more, as civilization gets more advanced, you create new rights all the time, right?
Yeah,
yeah, there's no natural right to a free press,
yeah,
in the state of nature. But once you have an advanced civilization, then you need natural right to a free press, natural right to a public attorney if you can't afford one. So the creation of new rights and their institutionalization in law as entitlements is the very definition of progress.
Exactly, of progress, of movement, of evolution. But I might get in trouble with that word with some people. But the point that you're making is that once you start talking about new rights, assuring rights, expanding rights, guaranteeing rights, now you're talking to something which it seems to me the majority of people are in favor of, and kind of takes the ladder out from under the other, the right, saying we're the ones that represent the founding fathers.
Well, if I can, poach on your turf,
yeah,
and give my own speech, what I would have said in terms of health care is I would have defined it in terms of a right to affordable health care. It's a right of all citizens. And that would have united the interests of the majority of people who have health care now because it's becoming unaffordable, with the minority who don't have any health care at all because their employers don't provide it. I think the once it was defined as extending coverage,
yeah,
then it became essentially a question for the people who have it. Are we going to lose ours in order to give it to mostly poor people?
And let me cut in, Michael, but don't you think that, 10 years, even in 94, let's say in 93, 94, when Clinton first was dealing with this, it did seem like the problem then was those not covered. But in the intervening 15 years, those who are covered have seen it isn't there when you need it, you're going to get cut off, you're going to lose it if you lose your job. So that while you may have had to, or would have been more likely to have to pitch it as expanding coverage back then, now everyone knows that their health care is in trouble, and it seems
this whole
challenge of how do you pitch something that looks like it only helps the poor to pitch it, in fact, because it helps everyone.
Well, the Democrats, to their credit, have made two arguments, not one. One is universal coverage. The other is health care costs are the greatest threat to the economy over the long term, not Social Security
exactly.
And healthcare by themselves. However, I'm very glad that Douglas Holtz-Eakin is in charge of the budget. I'm sorry that Peter Orszag is in charge instead of Douglas Holtz-Eakin. But having said that, is there a wimpier, wonkier way to make this cause than to say that, well, if we bend the curve on health care cost inflation, that will reduce federal deficits in 2040? I mean, that is not going to set the saloons on fire.
Bending the curve should be locked up in Al Gore's lockbox, don't you think? Have we heard two stupider ways?
And what's more, when you're making future deficit reduction rather than the rights of people right now who are losing their homes because they've had an illness, the focus.
The bankruptcies?
You're ceding the ground to the deficit hawks.
Yep.
Somehow it's illegitimate to have government spending.
Yeah. Let me go on this healthcare just a little bit more. So I think we both agree, because I've read your stuff, that single payer, that is tax-funded, universally available, not-for-profit health insurance with choice of providers, is probably best able to save the kind of money that we need to save before healthcare breaks us all, rather than just sending the unfortunate into bankruptcy. But if here's one thing I've wondered. If Obama knows that in his gut, is it harder to passionately argue for something you know is not the ultimate solution?
Well, I think there's been dishonesty on both sides, among the progressives as well as the centrist neoliberals. Because the truth is, the progressives, in private, in my experience, hope that the public option can grow into single payer. Okay?
Yeah. Not all of them universally, but yeah.
Right. I mean, and so, but I think that's why people support it. But then in public, they're saying, no, this won't do that. Well, if you have your fingers crossed behind your back, that's never a good strategy in arguing for something. Now, the people who focus on regulation of the healthcare industry rather than public option, they're not all evil people bought out by the insurance industry. A lot of these folks secretly behind the scenes argue that once you have these new regulations imposed on private insurance, you know, you have to take all who come, you have a $2,500 basic plan, things like that, this will consolidate the industry. It will eliminate a lot of small fly-by-night insurers. And you will get kind of an oligopoly with a few giant insurance companies. And at that point, you can gradually twist the noose and force them into something like regulated public utilities 10 or 20 years down the road. So I think the problem with both sides in this debate is they're not actually honest with the public about where they see this leading in 20 years.
Right.
The public option people, but also the people who oppose the public option. And it's sort of hard to promote something by stealth.
That's what I say. I mean, it's hard
because
to...
Because your enemies are going to sniff you out. They're
right.
going to sniff you out.
That sort of gut passion that I think you need, that if he were fighting for a Voting Rights Act, you know, he'd be able to do, I think, and I'm not just talking about Obama, I'm using him sort of symbolically, but I think, you know, once you admit to yourself that this is you're starting by going for a compromise, I think it's hard to pull out all the stops. So I think... Just because there's so much else going on, we should leave healthcare. But when the people have just gotten this huge, bitter dose of reality that forced them to admit or finally face the fact that investment banks and Wall Street were scamming the rest of us, why not kind of continue that narrative to say something similar about health insurance companies, not to put them out of business, but just to say, make your profit in the real world. Make it by providing great health and health care, not by, you know, cutting people out of their policies and jerking the floor out from under them. Be better at it than any public choice. I mean, it seemed to me there was a narrative one could have tagged onto.
Yeah, I think the narrative should be that we tamed industrial capitalism in the first half of the 20th century. And in the second half of the 20th century, financial capitalism evolved into something totally unprecedented in U.S. and world history. Much of it is good. Some of it is bad. If you go back to 1909, you have predatory power companies that don't provide electricity to much of the country and then overcharge and gouge people where electricity is provided. You have corporations, industrial corporations, that are very productive and very valuable, but they're ruthlessly crushing unions and poisoning consumers. Did we get rid of corporations? Did we get rid of electricity? No. But we boosted unions, we regulated companies, and we had the government come in. Talk about a public option. That's what the Tennessee Valley Authority was.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Lower Colorado River, we had public electrical utilities competed with private power. We had antitrust. Right now, we have a completely new kind of capitalism that's about 20 or 30 years old. It's financial market capitalism. Banks account for about a fifth of the financial business now. It's pension funds, it's hedge funds, it's all of these structured investment vehicles, and we're not going to go back to the old, you know, simple savings bank, you know, loaning to the business.
Right, Bedford Falls and George Bailey, yeah.
But we need to do to financial market capitalism what the New Deal did to industrial capitalism half a century ago. That's the story I would tell.
Yeah, one of the things, I really like that, actually, because it ties it not only to sort of, it doesn't just point the finger and say they're doing something bad. It says this is what you have to do. This is what happens. Something grows up, it gets strong, and then it has to be tamed, and it's just a natural progression. One of the things that I recall realizing, I don't know, 20 years ago or so, was that an awful lot of corporations actually were making a good percentage of their profits from their investments, not from what it was they were producing.
Well, if you look at the 1990s, there was this unprecedented pattern where corporations were buying back their stock to bid it up, so that suckers would then buy their shares. And the data for this, you can find this in Robert Brenner of UCLA, has done a lot of writing about this in the New Left Review and elsewhere. So, there's a lot of gaming of the system. But it's kind of the debate with regard to these new financial markets, I think, it's kind of like the debate over industry. In the 1930s, the agrarians opposed the New Dealers. The agrarians said, these are the last heirs of the William Jennings Bryan populace, let's just not have industry, let's not have manufacturing, let's not have large corporations. And the New Deal liberals said, well, no, we're not going to, you know, go back to the 19th century, but we're going to have regulated corporations that serve the public interest. And, it wasn't utopia, but that we had a system where corporations were tamed, where banking was subordinate to productive industry from the 1940s up until the 1970s. And I think a lot of people want to just go back to the New Deal, you know, Glass-Steagall, right?
Right.
The New Deal economic regulations.
And to explain to people what that is.
Yeah, Glass-Steagall was a New Deal law that separated ordinary commercial banking from investment banking.
Right.
And then the Republican Congress, with the support of the Clinton administration and of Robert Rubin, who was Clinton's Secretary of the Treasury, got rid of it and deregulated it and allowed these universal banks to do both investment banking and, you know, ordinary commercial deposit banking. And so, you know, arguably that did help cause the crisis, but there's a problem with this narrative among progressives. Australia and Canada have universal banks, and they've always have had these big universal banks. They never had anything like Glass-Steagall. So the investment banking, commercial banking have always been fused in the same giant banks. They were hardly affected by this crisis. You know, they didn't buy the toxic loans because they were very tightly regulated. You know, and so I think, again, you have to be very careful because this is a very complex technical area. You can't simply assume that, well, we'll go back to the way the system was before the 90s. You know, or
right.
Back in the 1930s, as
right.
opposed to taking a careful look at it and saying, okay, what aspects of this are useful?
Mm-hmm.
So there are some, you know, financial innovation now has become kind of a swear word because a lot of these innovations were either crooked or disastrous in unintended ways. But, you know, something like securitization, that's not a bad thing in itself. You know,
and again, for anyone who doesn't know, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's a useful thing if it's done in a reasonable, plain vanilla way. If you do it in a Baroque, psychotic LSD way, you know, it
yeah.
leads to disaster. So I just think people have to be careful. You know, we want to go forward.
Yeah. You know, one of the ways that Michael, one of the ways that I sort of look at a lot of things nowadays is it broken? What's the evidence?
Right.
How did it get broken? What's the history? Who are the culprits? You know, what's the narrative? And then how do we fix it? And it seems to me if you kind of look at things that way, you know, you may have a chance of not making those sorts of mistakes. It's interesting. You took us right into the financial area. What are some of your thoughts?
Some sort of bailout was necessary. Now, you know, the way we did it, I think will cause, you know, scandals, you know, for years to come. But there's no doubt, because every country engaged in massive bailouts of its financial sector and stimulus. And we did learn the lessons of the Depression. I think you can make a case that the Obama administration and even, you know, Paulson, the late Bush administration, may have averted depression simply by pumping money into the economy. It's done in a very wasteful and sometimes corrupt way. Now, going forward with regulation, this is where I become very nervous, because all of the people who know Wall Street very well in the City of London tell me any regulation you can come up with will be circumvented by these really smart, well-paid people in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. That's their job. And that's their genius.
And so, you know, here's what I would propose. If we want some straightforward activity done, for example, you know, giving 35-year home mortgages, you know, to working-class people, then why don't we think of doing this through a public or quasi-public entity? I mean, that's what we did with Fannie and Freddie Mae, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which worked quite well before they were privatized. See, the regulatory approach assumes that you have these for-profit entities, and first that they're going to obey the regulations, even though that means they lose money. And then on top of that, the neoliberal approach is we will bribe for-profit corporations into doing a public service that they would not do otherwise, because there's no profit in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have this alternate tradition, including the TVA, including Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, of creating government-sponsored enterprises. You know, and they can be private nominally, like a lot of public power utilities are nominally private, and you make a small profit, but their rates are controlled. And I have a piece on utility capitalism called In Defense of Goliath in the latest issue of Democracy Journal. And I point out that that was the New Deal model, that is sometimes you created a public or a public-private entity for a public purpose instead of trying to take some for-profit industry and either force them or bribe them into carrying out what really the government should do in the first place.
Hmm. Interesting. I remember just popped into my head, I was in the early 90s at the only media person at a gathering of corporate environmental managers from all over the world. And I remember one of them saying, look, let's all admit it, without regulation we wouldn't be doing any of this. Once the regulation's there, then we try to find the smartest, most efficient, most profitable way of doing it.
Right.
And I think that's just often the case.
But this goes back to the health care. The fundamental question is, do we want more health care or do we want more health insurance?
Exactly. Or do
insurance is a means to the end. It's
that's right.
End.
And I would say, by the way, health, number one. Health care, number two. Health insurance, number three.
Even better.
Because more health care often just means more tests,
right.
more technology. Let me ask about another area, which I don't know is in your bailiwick, but certainly seems to be related to all this, which is food, agriculture, the farm bill, and the influence there again, which is my running theme, the influence of money. As I said, the people may have woken up or may have gone to bed on November 4th thinking they'd achieved a great victory, but on November 5th, the lobbyists started figuring out how to work.
Well, I think you want to, at this point in history, you want to distinguish the ordinary lobbies from the oligarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Simon Johnson, former, I think he's an IMF official, World Bank official maybe, did a piece for The Atlantic a few months ago that got a lot of attention, saying that there's now a financial political oligarchy in the U.S. of the kind that he has observed in Russia and in Latin America and various developing countries. I think in ordinary times there are lots of special interest groups, including the farm lobby and, you know, manufacturers and pharma and various other groups. And in normal times, the reformers want, you know, just to keep the public interest from being perverted by them. I think right now there's this one group that has grown so cancerously, and that's the financial industry, in terms of its influence in both parties, you know, in the media,
mm-hmm,
and everything,
mm-hmm.
That in a way, you know, I think it's best to focus the energy. You know, so for example, and I think there have been these oligarchies that were just totally warped the system before, around the 1900s.
Yes.
It was the Northeastern manufacturing, you know, robber barons. If you go back to the 1850s, it was the Southern planters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they controlled one party and intimidated the other. And so if it's the 1850s, well, you may want to go after the New England textile merchants, you know, who want tariffs, but really it's the slave owners who are the problem facing the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's my way of not getting into, you know, the agricultural question, which I think is significant. But, you know, given this, I think the central issue of our time is how do we cut the claws and tame this enormous monster of the financial industry.
I see. In other words, that what distorts everything else.
Yeah, and we can deal with the ordinary corruption later.
Okay. I'm with you.
That's not a cop-out, I hope.
Right.
But no.
Although, let me just say, I'll let you say that, and let me say that for me, the Farm Bill, which subsidizes basically a few crops that often don't lead to healthy food, and actually by that sort of inhibit other crops and other things, is one of those where it passes every 5 years because it matters most to a few farm state senators. Other senators and congressmen do trade-offs, and just as, you know, it looks like a few guys on the Senate Finance Committee are figuring out, you know, the health plan, a few guys figure out this country's agricultural policy, which ends up being our food policy, which ends up being our health policy in certain dimensions. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, that's true. That's true of the transportation bill as well.
Yep.
You know, every five, the highway bill.
Yep.
You know, and so I go back and forth because it's always, you know, some kind of monstrous, you know, chimera, you know, created
yes.
by committees. But on the other hand, I have to say, you know, as bad as the Congress is, would we be better off if our legislature had less power and we were run totally by people associated with Goldman Sachs and the revolving door?
No, of course not.
Branch?
Of course
you
not.
Know, so I always end up defending, you know, even the crookedest, you know, members of the House of Representatives, because their crookedness is visible. You
yeah.
know, it is there on C-SPAN cameras. Well, a lot of it, some of it's behind closed doors. The deals that are going on. See, we talk about the president as one person, and then there are these hundreds of members of Congress. But actually, the executive branch is hundreds and thousands of people, right? The president is not running everything
mm-hmm.
24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
But what goes on in the executive branch is secret. It doesn't matter, Democratic president, Republican president, there are not C-SPAN cameras there,
mm-hmm.
you know, at these meetings between, you know, we don't know what Larry Summers is telling Barack Obama every morning.
Or what went on in the meeting when Barack Obama made a deal with the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, so my only point is, if since all of the sleaziness of Congress is out in the open, you know, whereas the president, and again, as any president can come out in front of a bunch of flags, you know, and give a rehearsed speech, well, then you think, oh, the president is so dignified and, you know, Congress is so corrupt.
Right.
I'm just saying, you have to keep that disparity of publicity in mind.
Yeah, that of transparency,
yes.
of sunshine and so on. I have said for years that all issue-oriented activists should forget their single issues and work together for public financing until they make it happen, because otherwise they are all just David's against Goliath's on all of their single issues. Now, I understand that that isn't just politics, that it would call for clever innovations to get over the Supreme Court's free speech obstacles, but without it, it seems to me, the common good consistently gets shortchanged, democracy is a lie, and people end up getting cynical, resigned, and desperate. Public financing, what do you think, Michael?
Well, as long as it can go to the parties and not just members of Congress. See, the reason special interests have so much influence over individual representatives and senators in our system is that what other democracies use to fund races, that is the party's money, you know, the party, the Labor Party,
right.
Britain, Social Democrats in Germany, that's called soft money, and it's been defined as something bad by Progressive Act. I think that's a terrible strategic mistake. So, for example, if the Democratic Party could give one of these blue dog members of Congress who's wavering now, right, in a crucial area, could just pour money into his or her next race, then when the insurance lobby came up and said, you know, you just barely got elected, you could lose. If you don't vote for us, we're going to, you know, give millions to your primary challenger. At that point, you know, that congressman could say, screw you. The Democratic Party nationwide has a huge war chest. I don't need to listen to you. I don't need to listen to the telecom lobby, right? You know, now, it is true that it somewhat reduces the link between the local district.
Exactly.
Right? But we've seen through history that if you can't pay, you know, give great sums to individual members of Congress in marginal races, Well, they're going to raise those great sums, and they're going to raise it from lobbies.
But what I'm saying is,
they can't raise it from the party.
Is that if we did what Maine has done to some extent, what Vermont has done to some extent, what Arizona has done to some extent, which is...
Well, I'm agreeing with you,
okay.
But it's just this question of
you wouldn't give it all to the individual...
pool their resources. That's, that's something that's critical.
Right, so that they would... Perhaps that they would have both. That the parties could get money and that the... And as I say to any libertarian who goes, I don't want to give them another damn dollar, it's like just... You know, look at the smartest investment any corporation makes is in political donations. Nothing pays off.
The public financing transferable because most members of Congress are in safe seats. And if you have a system where they can loan the money they don't need to the members of their party in these swing areas, then you don't. You're less likely to get the situation we have now with these very insecure Democrats,
exactly.
You know, sort of floating between the Republicans and the Democrats.
Right, the ones who won in a conservative district and didn't win by a lot.
Okay,
let me ask you a final question here. I recall the excitement on November 4th and watching it in Grant Park, and I began rooting for Obama early in his campaign because he struck me as far and away the candidate who most embodied the charismatic optimist. And in my experience, Americans, if they're going to entertain change, gravitate toward charismatic optimists. Franklin Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, John Kennedy, Bill Clinton a bit, and so on. And so when I looked at the crisis we were in and the various candidates, I said, that's who could do it. And I thought, as I said, the wind was at his back, you know, when he was elected. And my feelings were really not so much that he was the genius, but I had great hopes that this was the best opportunity for real change since Kennedy Johnson. How did you feel that night? How do you feel now?
Well, my interpretation was this was a historic turning point. It was like the 1932 election or 1860. And I think historians will look back and say the conservative era ended and a new one would begin. However, because I think this is a long-term trend, it would have ended even if John McCain had been elected.
Mm.
Right. Now, the way I look at Obama, if you looked at if you were a Lincoln supporter in the early months of the Lincoln administration, you would have thought he was a wimp, right? Because he was trying to cut deals with the South, and emancipation was well into the future. If you looked at Franklin Roosevelt 6 months into his reign, it was the National Recovery Administration, which most people agree is a total disaster.
Right.
So I think come back in the midterm elections, Lincoln and Roosevelt, when the first things they tried failed, they were ruthless about firing people and bringing in new blood and trying something else. They just tried different things until it worked. And that's the test, you know. Can Obama, you know, say, okay, look, we tried compromise. We tried this kind of warmed over Clintonian neoliberalism. It's not working. We have 10% unemployment. We're going to try something else.
Okay.
Or is he going to stay the course?
Yeah.
I think that's the test.
I think you're right. And let me just say one thing that occurred to me as I was preparing for this is with his devotion to bipartisanship and compromise, is he living in the past? Is he remembering when the state of Illinois included people like Everett Dirksen and Charles Percy and ignoring?
I don't think he was born then.
You might be right. Okay. Again, go to newamerica.net for links to Michael Lind's books and articles, which he referred to a few of them as we've been talking. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to our podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. So for podcasts, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of this world that just might work, you email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, and you can also learn how to get on my weekly email and ask me, and I'll put you on my weekly email announcement list and tell you who's going to be on what we're going to talk about. Also, I suggest check out alternet.org, alternet. The lead article today is a print version of my recent interview with Ben Skinner about modern-day slavery. I look forward to being with you again next week. Thank you, Michael Lind, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.